Welcome to
Behind the Beat,
a podcast hosted by Sylvia
and Maya.
Nate Sloan is a professor of musicology at the USC Thornton School of Music, and he's also a performer who researches jazz, Tin Pan Alley, and popular music. Sloan also hosts a podcast called Switched on Pop with songwriter Charlie Harding, a podcast produced by Vox Media, which has been cited by Rolling Stone, The Guardian, and Entertainment Weekly as the top music podcast, and he provides music analysis for The Economist, NPR, The Atlantic, The Boston Globe, and CBC Radio's Day 6. Nate Sloan, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first, we kind of want to go into your background and musical experience. So could you tell us how you decided to pursue this career?
I was a musician all through high school playing jazz piano. And then when I started college, I thought that I wanted to try something new. I started taking classes in environmental science. And about a year later, I realized that I wasn't very good at science. So I returned to my love of music, but I still didn't feel like I really was destined to be a performer. And so I looked for other ways to be involved with music. And then I found this study that I'd never heard of before called musicology. And I learned that it was studying the history and the sound of music. And I started taking classes, and I quickly fell in love with it. And by the time I graduated, my mentor, my advisor, encouraged me to apply to grad school to do a PhD in musicology. I applied to a few schools, and I was accepted to Stanford University. And I studied there and completed my dissertation about Harlem jazz in the 1920s and 30s. And from there, I was fortunate enough to secure a position teaching musicology at the University of Southern California.
Wow, that's awesome. So what was it about musicology in particular that kind of drew you to that discipline?
I really liked a few things. One was being able to better understand why certain music moved me and the role that music played in our society. Mm. And being able to have the tools to discuss music in a really technical and specific kind of way. And then I also had the opportunity to start teaching, and I discovered that I really loved being in the classroom and being able to share knowledge and facilitate discussions. And that all made me feel like this was a really good fit for me as a career.
I think one thing that was really cool about your class and your career in general is how you kind of combine performance and musicology in kind of a more academic setting. So how do you think the two play a role in influencing one another?
I think to be able to write about music, to be able to talk about music, you have to have some experience playing music. You don't have to be an expert, a virtuoso. But you need to know what it feels like to sit down at an instrument or to sing, to make music with other people. The more you understand the process of making music, the better you can articulate that and explain it to mm-hmm. other people. So yeah. I see those two things as deeply connected.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you.
Yeah.
Do you want to do musicology?
Yes. So we were blessed enough to have you as our teacher for Music and Ideas back in sophomore year, and we learned a lot and were introduced to new concepts and ideas about music that we never even thought about growing up playing music. I know you kind of gave a brief history already and just kind of gave us an idea of what it is, but what do you think is the motive you wanted from your class? Like what's the message you wanted from the class and the relevance that it has for performers and musicians that are coming from so many different backgrounds, whether it's in pop, jazz, or classical? I think that was a really unique part of it, is that it wasn't just catered for classical or pop or jazz, it's combining everyone. And I think your class was the first class for everyone to be together in the first space, in the same space. So what did you want? What was the message you really wanted to provide and like let us know as students from this class?
Well, first of all, I also feel blessed that I had you both in my class, so the feeling is mutual. And when I teach musicology, I think of myself as helping musicians gain skills like being able to communicate about the music that they play and the music that they love and the music they compose, being able to contextualize the music they make, the history of it, the social cultural meaning of it, and being able to engage creatively with music through this critical lens, mm-hmm. because ultimately you don't need to know history to be a good musician. I as much as I would like to think that's true, I don't really believe that.
Yeah.
Music is intuitive. It's spontaneous. It's expressive. But I do feel like to be a successful musician in the 21st century,
mm-hmm.
it helps to be able to have that intellectual framework to understand why your music matters and why it's worth sharing, and being able to communicate that to people,
mm-hmm.
and to be able to generate new creative avenues for yourself as a musician. Having that thought process, it's not indispensable,
right.
but I think it's helpful.
And when you were building this curriculum, I understand there's probably professors before you that were teaching this, but how was the process of building it, and what concepts were you thinking of when you were creating the curriculum for this class?
So the course Music and Ideas offered at Thornton School of Music mm-hmm. is very unique
uh-huh.
because typically a school would have a class called an introduction to Western music or music appreciation or something like that.
Yeah.
And this course is a little different. It's reaching out to all different backgrounds of student at Thornton,
mm-hmm.
pop students, classical students, jazz students. And the material doesn't follow a set repertoire or even a set time period. It really ranges from all of those different disciplines and all different moments in history. So on one hand, that's really exciting. And on the other hand, it's also a challenge. How do you decide what is appropriate and necessary to cover? For me, building the syllabus was about finding key examples from each of those styles of music, classical, jazz, pop, that spoke to larger themes that come up for us as working musicians in the 2020s.
Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to make sure we were able to talk about issues of identity, issues of politics, issues of musical meaning and technology. And once I had those themes, then I looked for specific musical examples that could help us connect to and express those themes. So to name one example, thinking of the relationship of music and politics, we did a class about the use of rap lyrics in criminal trials. And that allowed us to listen to specific songs, but also talk about more generally the way that music is perceived and how that can change the way we view an individual as well.
That's actually a really good segue into our next topic, which is music and cultural influences. I think personally, one of my favorite takeaways from your class was the whole unit on how identity, society, and culture are very much intertwined with music. So I'm wondering, kind of in a nutshell, how would you say that our identity influences the music that we play and listen to, and also vice versa?
We like to think that music is a universal art, and that's something I feel like you hear over and over again. But I think the reality is that our backgrounds, the way we were raised, our cultures, this shapes the way we hear things.
Right.
We don't all hear in the same way. And ultimately, that's a good thing, because it means a single piece of music can be interpreted in all these different ways. And I feel like part of the reason I'm drawn to musicology is because it allows me to hear a piece of music through someone else's ears. And I can understand what they respond to when they listen to that and how it resonates with them. And sometimes there are kinds of music that I don't really gravitate towards. Like death metal comes to mind as an example. I don't really go around listening to death metal, but I like trying to understand why someone would want to listen to that mm-hmm. and what they would get out of it. And the answer might surprise you, because death metal is a very violent, intense music, but for a lot of the listeners, it gives them a lot of peace and comfort to listen to. So I think music is a way to understand our common humanity mm-hmm. because it is so connected to the way we perceive ourselves.
Yeah, I'm going to chime in real quick. And I think that question asked as a whole, how do you think identity and the way our background and society influenced the way we perceive music? But how do you think your own personal like background and identity influenced the way you personally perceive music and hear music?
Well, I grew up as a fan of jazz, mm-hmm. and I think that made me feel slightly separate socially from my peers, mm-hmm. because I at that time in my life I wasn't listening to pop music, I wasn't listening to Britney Spears, and if I was, I'm completely honest, I probably said some really mean things about a lot of pop artists that my friends were listening to. So I think from an early age, the fact that I love jazz made me feel like a little different mm-hmm. and gave me a sort of sense of having a unique identity that was maybe outside of the mainstream. Mm-hmm. And I think part of my growth as a person was getting older and starting to expose myself and listen to other styles of music and being more welcoming and open to different sounds. Mm-hmm. And the more I allowed myself to do that, the not only did my musical taste expand, but I think I became, frankly, like a more sympathetic and understanding person in general.
Yeah.
So for me, that was kind of my voyage, was like, I think I was more of kind of a jazz snob when I was when I was younger.
Yeah.
And then as I grew older, I came to embrace all styles of music mm-hmm. and kind of become a more open person as well.
That's so interesting. Yeah. My next question is kind of something that's being talked a lot among Gen Z people specifically, because we have this whole cancel culture and social media definitely plays a factor into that. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the separation of the artist and the art.
This is one of the most important questions, I think, mm-hmm. because as music makers and music consumers, it's not just a abstract question. It has a lot of implications, what kind of choices we make in terms of the music we listen to. One way I think through this issue is, in terms of separating the art and the artist, I don't really believe that there's such thing as a bad song.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think music itself is harmful. I think the way that people use music and interpret music sometimes can be harmful, but as an art form, I don't believe music is intrinsically harmful. So I do believe in separating the art and the artist.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not always so simple. If you listen to an artist, I'm just going to use one notable example, R. Kelly, who is currently imprisoned for a number of charges, including sexual assault, is listening to an R. Kelly song a morally objectionable act? Well, in terms of enjoying the music, no, I don't think so. But by streaming a song or downloading it or buying it, are you materially supporting a criminal who is perpetrating really bad actions in the world? Yeah, you're putting money in his pocket. So in that instance, it's a little more complicated. Maybe you shouldn't be listening to that music.
Mm-hmm.
But is the music itself, quote unquote, bad? I don't feel that way.
I think this topic is also interesting because, yes, it is a relevant topic within pop culture and Gen Z, like you mentioned, but also us as classical musicians who are playing music written in a very different generational time when different ideas and concepts right. were accepted, and us as classical musicians, we're playing music that are written by maybe not so... maybe men that... people. Yeah, we might not necessarily support the decisions they were making back, but we are still honoring and playing that music to this day. So I think it's a really interesting topic and one that can be fleshed out even more. But
I think the only difference is that they're not profiting off of
right, yeah.
They're not profiting on it, and you know, possibly... You, as artists, we can engage with that repertoire and find ways to acknowledge the abuse or the violence or the hate that artist you know espoused. Maybe there's even a way to engage with that in our performances today and not try and pretend it didn't exist or erase it, but actually make it part of the performance.
Okay, thank you so much. Our next topic that we also talked about in our music and ideas class was kind of the era of like the musical genius. What does that even mean to be a musical genius? Like within like the classical music canon, can you, for those of people who might not even know what that necessarily means, can you give us a brief kind of explanation of
The idea of genius is an idea that only emerged relatively recently in the 1800s, and it was to signify an individual who possessed a musical gift of some kind, an ability that was preternatural, that was prodigious, that was, you know, maybe something that came to them when they were just a child even, and set them apart from the rest of the musical world. In classical music, probably the first notable example of this is Beethoven, a composer who really, whose singular musical language was so influential that it really changed the course of classical music fundamentally. And he was borderline worshipped by the generation of European composers that came after him in the 1800s. And there was something, so that became a new benchmark, you know, not just are you talented, are you creative, but are you a genius? Is there something special, and do you have that aura about you? It's not something that you can define clearly, but it was something that became really prized in 19th century European culture. And I wouldn't say there's anything necessarily wrong with it, but if we fast forward from there, I feel like we've seen that this idea of genius has been really destructive in some ways, because it puts some artists on a pedestal and allows them, in some cases, it allows them to behave badly, and they get away with it because they are, quote, geniuses. In other cases, it makes it seem like it doesn't matter how hard you work or how much you dedicate yourself to your craft. It's just you're born a genius or you're not. Mm-hmm. And that, I think that's a really harmful notion. Mm-hmm. And then finally, I think the idea of genius can be really destructive because it's not something that you can really categorize, and there's no consensus on who actually is a genius and who's not. So it's not a really helpful term necessarily. Right. So I see increasingly people who make music and write about music are trying to move away from that word. Mm-hmm. And just not think of genius and think more of how are people being creative and thoughtful, and that seems like a better way to think about
100%.
People making music.
Yeah, I think it's also related to the word prodigy in the sense that both, in my opinion, kind of negate the effort and dedication that is required for like composing music or performing music. And I think that kind of seeing it as this God-given gift is problematic in some ways.
Yeah, I agree.
Oh, are we done with that one?
Yeah.
Okay, so now we kind of want to talk about the future. How do you see the music industry evolving in the next 10 years? So this could relate to, like, technology and AI, or just the music industry in general.
There are a few changes in the industry that are happening right now that I think will intensify. And one is that as music as a commodity becomes less valued, artists have to find other ways to generate a sustainable income from music. What I mean is that the value of a piece of music has steadily decreased and really plummeted as a result of the introduction of streaming services in the early 2000s. When you pay a subscription to stream an infinite library of music, the value of an individual song or recording goes way down. Mm-hmm. And there's no shortage of evidence and stories of musicians being unable to make a living by sharing their music on a streaming service like Spotify. So when the value of recorded music goes down, musicians are forced to find other ways to generate income. Live performance is probably the single biggest one of those. And live performances have become, I think, much more valued in recent years, sometimes in a way that makes them unaffordable because so many people desire tickets to see a certain artist. Taylor Swift, maybe, or Beyonce come to mind. And then beyond that, artists have to be creative. They might have to become influencers on social media. They might have to find ways to license their music for use in other media. They might have to teach music or come up with some other creative way of marketing their music. So on one hand, I'm distressed by the fact that the value of music has really gone down significantly as a result of its digitization. But on the other hand, I think having musicians become more rounded individuals who are able to express themselves in a variety of ways is not necessarily a bad thing. But ultimately, the biggest concern is, how are musicians going to be able to support themselves? And I do see there being more challenges in that respect as tech companies have really just eaten into the incomes of artists, at least in terms of their recorded music. So I see that as one of the biggest things for musicians to navigate in the future.
So would you say it's necessary for musicians who are starting their careers now to build diverse careers and have many different hats that they wear? Or is it still possible to just be a performer or just be a musicologist?
It's definitely possible still to commit yourself to one monastic kind of pursuit. It's probably rarer to be able to sustain that today. I think being a well-rounded musician, I don't love the word entrepreneurial, so I'm not going to use that. But yeah, to be a musician with a diverse set of skills, is not only maybe practical to have a successful career in the existing music landscape, but may also be artistically rewarding as well. You know, I think about musicians who in the past would just go from conservatory to a role as a oboist in a symphony. Increasingly, those positions are harder to find, but that's not a net negative, because in some ways being creating your own, being put in the position of having to create your own musical identity beyond the confines of an existing institution can be a really powerful creative exercise and can lead you to skills that you wouldn't obtain otherwise. Mm. To record yourself, perhaps to write your own arrangements, to collaborate with other musicians. These are all things that aren't really privileged in the old way of doing things, at least in the classical music world. Yeah. So on one hand, I don't, the precarity of a career in music concerns me, but the increased opportunities for creativity and collaboration actually kind of excites me.
Yeah, it kind of forces you to think outside the box. Yeah. And our last question is a little bit self-serving. Since you are a college professor, sure. What advice would you give to students who are about to transition from college to professional life?
Great question. I mean, there's a few things. I think that it's really important to stay connected to the thing that you love about music. And that might not be a career where you're making music 100% of the time. And in some ways, I feel like the best advice or insight I could give a graduating student is, if you choose not to pursue a career as a full-time musician, you have not failed. You have not disappointed your teachers and your professors and your mentors. You have not betrayed yourself. The only thing that you owe the world and yourself, I think, is to treasure and celebrate the things that you love about music. Mm-hmm. So if you end up being an accountant who plays music in an amateur chamber group on the side, and you email me, you know, 5-10 years from now and tell me that, I'll be thrilled to hear that, you know? I won't be like, oh, she, you know, Maya and Sylvia, they had so much promise and then they threw it away or something like that. I'll be like, as long as you have music in your life in a way that you, yeah, that you love it and it like gives you that sense of joy and satisfaction, like, then I'm happy. I remember when my advisor, my mentor as an undergraduate, told me that, when he said, cause we had been talking about applying to musicology, like I told you earlier, mm-hmm, applying to musicology grad programs. And he said, hey, I just need you to know, if you decide you don't want to do this, I will support you 100%. And him saying that was like, I was like, ooh, it just like took this weight off my shoulders. And I ended up doing it, mm-hmm, in part because he kind of gave me the freedom to say no. So I think the skills that you learn in music school are really applicable to a variety of careers and paths. I mean, not all of them. I don't know that you'll be, you know, doing 4-part species counterpoint at your, you know, job as a marketer or a doctor or whatever it is. But I think some of the general skills that you learn as a musician, you learn a lot of self-initiative. You learn a lot about collaboration. You learn a lot about working under deadlines. Yeah. And you learn a lot about pushing yourself beyond what you thought was possible. These are all things that are so valuable and applicable to like a huge variety of different careers. So to me, I would say, whatever comes next for you, try not to put too much pressure on yourself to quote unquote make it as a musician. I would say it's more important to sort of put your love for music at the forefront and to follow that and see where it takes you. And where it takes you may not be as a violinist in a symphony or a session musician or a classical music influencer on TikTok or whatever. It may be to somewhere else completely different, but you'll still have music as a part of your life. And I think, again, that's just, ultimately, that's what I care about. Not you, not anyone making it as a musician.
Yeah. Thank you so much, because, you know, we're on as seniors about to graduate undergrad, and there's so many different things that we could go through with here. You know, we're at a pretty pivotal point of deciding what we want for ourselves, and obviously being aware of like what this new generation and the future has, and hearing someone like you, like a mentor, a teacher, give us those like words of hope and advice is very comforting for us. And also thank you for just being a part of this and just telling us about musicology and, you know, how you came to be. We're very honored to have you.
Thank you.
We're very lucky that we had to have you as a professor as well.
Thank you so much.
That's really cool to hear. I'll just say one more thing on that. You know, when I didn't go directly to grad school from undergraduate. Mm-hmm. I spent maybe 2 years working part-time at a radio station and just playing a lot of music with my friends. Mm-hmm. And it was some of the best times I've had in my life. And I really wasn't putting a lot of pressure on myself. And I was working enough to pay my rent. Mm-hmm. And other than that, I was just meeting people and making music for fun and taking opportunities when they came up. And I feel like not everyone's able to do that because of the specific circumstances of your life and you know, depending on where you live and how much your rent costs and all of these kind of variables. But I think there is something to be said for after you graduate college, not like necessarily throwing yourself into the next thing and just sort of letting yourself enjoy life a little bit and just growing as a person and then seeing where that takes you.
Welcome to
Behind the Beat,
a podcast hosted by Sylvia
and Maya.